This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under-the-radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Zach Gorchow. The head of the Michigan Department of Corrections, Heidi Washington, has come under fire recently. Some members of the state legislature have gone so far as to call for her resignation. But it's not because of any new scandal or incident in the prisons.
That's right. State Representative Sarah Leitner, who represents a big part of Jackson County, which has a lot of residents who work in corrections, says that Washington hasn't improved the working conditions for the MDOC employees. She says that for 6 years, the department has been losing corrections officers faster than they can replace them, leading to staffing shortages, low morale, depression and anxiety, and dangerous working conditions.
This comes on the heels of the union that represents corrections officers calling on Governor Gretchen Whitmer to enlist the help of the National Guard to assist with security at state prisons. Whitmer has not responded to this request for comment from Gongwer or other news organizations, and the MDOC has not taken any action to pursue the request, so it seems like a dead letter. However, the department keeps saying that safety is paramount in Michigan prisons.
So, Zach, I want to dive into this a little bit more. We've known about staffing shortages for a while now. And in fairness to the department, I mean, this is not an easy job to convince people to do. It's long hours. You're trying to rein in people who don't want to be there. It's inherently dangerous. You know, the prisons are not located in booming economic areas. They're, you know, sort of like out in the country. They're not in cities. I mean, it's a tough ask. Is there anything the department can do to make this job more desirable, to improve this staffing problem?
I mean, the department is facing a difficult problem. And to be clear, this is one every state faces. This is a national problem, particularly after the pandemic when the number of corrections officers nationwide fell sharply. We've seen that the Michigan Department of Corrections is trying new strategies. I've seen commercials to go work for the Department of Corrections on television during football games. They're at job fairs. They're constantly running academies. Every year, there's money in the budget to train new officers. But they keep losing existing officers to retirement and attrition because people just don't want to work there anymore. For now, key Democrats say they still support Washington as director because they believe she is doing what she can and Michigan is not alone.
Yeah, MDOC keeps saying that they're working hard to address these shortages. They're, you know, trying to improve working environments for the staff. They're negotiating raises and focusing on recruitment and retention. But officers are still frequently expected to work 16-hour shifts, and nearly half of Michigan's prisons have a staff vacancy rate of over 20%. I mean, that's huge. And because this is a job where you can't have like one or two people missing in a shift, if you don't have the officers there, you get stuck with a lot of mandatory overtime, to say nothing of having a hard time getting a vacation.
Yeah, there's no such thing as remote work in a Michigan prison. You're
exactly
in the prison, and I don't think any of us have any clue as to how difficult and dangerous that work is. And I think that's part of what's driving the frustration with Washington, though, are these intense amount of overtime and hours. You know, she's been director for 9 years. And while many others have praised her, and that includes the governor, for a lot of innovations she's had in helping inmates transition back into society with jobs and being prepared to join the workforce, officers are exhausted. And she's the most obvious target, having been there since 2015. But ultimately, this is Governor Whitmer's call, and she has never been anything but a full-throated supporter of Heidi Washington.
So we're going to take a quick break here, but stick around because we're going to change gears. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Spencer Nevins from the Michigan Beer and Wine Wholesalers to talk about all things boozy. Stick around.
Welcome back to Mishmash. Today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite topics, one of Shayna's favorite topics, and one of Michigan's favorite topics, beer and wine. Joining us as our guest is Spencer Nevins, president of the Michigan Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association. Spencer, welcome to Mishmash.
Thanks, Zach. Yeah, glad to be here.
Great. Well, Spencer, I think most people in Michigan probably don't know what a wholesaler is. They just go to their favorite retailer to buy their favorite drink. Can you give us the elevator version of what your members do and the state's three-tier system, which I think is probably also not commonly known?
Sure, right. So let's start with the three-tier system. The state of Michigan, like most states, requires a licensed system for the sale of beer and wine. And the first tier are your licensed suppliers or manufacturers. They're the people that are making it. So think of Gallo on the wine side. Think of Anheuser-Busch, Molson Coors, you know, on the beer side. Those are suppliers. They're in the supplier tier. Then you have the wholesaler tier, which is where distributors are. And that's my members. Suppliers are required to sell their product to a distributor. Then the distributor sells it to the third tier, which are the retailers. So we bridge the gap between the supplier and the retailer to make sure that retailer is getting all the products that they want. So that's the three-tier system. And as I just started, our members, we fill that role of getting that product from the supplier to the retailer, all the marketing, merchandising. So when you see point of sale, that's all done by our members. When you see the product on the shelves, that's our members. We rotate it, merchandise it, and help build the brands for the retailer and the supplier.
Can you walk us through what the benefits are of this system? I mean, it seems like a lot of regulation and sort of very specific buckets that we're talking about here. Why not just deregulate it?
Well, you had the deregulated system, you know, before Prohibition, and obviously that's a long, long time ago, but you had suppliers that owned everything. So terms that you've heard before, like lock, stock, and barrel, that's an old alcohol term. The suppliers owned everything, right? They owned the locks on the doors of the retailers. They owned all the stock. They owned all the barrels. They owned everything. And we had, when you think about the United States, you don't think about a country that's generally into prohibiting people from being able to try things, right? But we actually did that. We eliminated alcohol because the abuse was so bad. So coming out of that, they wanted the supplier separated from the end sale part, right? From the retail side. And so they came up with the license system and put distributors in there. Distributors are required to be located in the state. They have to have bricks and mortar in the state. And that's where the state regulatory authorities can check to make sure taxes are being paid. The product is required to be stored in the warehouse so they can come and test that product, observe it. So it really was born from just abuse. And, you know, I think if you look at our marijuana side right now, that's just getting started, you're seeing abuse, right? You're seeing billboards, get a marijuana for free for a year. Get a car with marijuana. Those same types of things happened with alcohol. It led to abuse. And the system was created to curtail it so that you can balance sales along with public health and safety. And I think over time, we're going to see that happen with the marijuana industry as well.
Spencer, your group, the Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association, has long been one of the most active players in the legislature seeking changes to state alcohol laws. And there's a bill moving right now, and it just passed the Senate a couple weeks ago, that would prohibit retailers from selling something called co-branded alcohol. What's that bill all about, and what does your association think of it?
So it doesn't prohibit the selling of co-branded. It puts in guidelines for how you're going to market it. So What you're really talking about is a traditional brand that didn't have alcohol, right? Like a Mountain Dew. Or a Sunny Delight, right? Sunny D. They didn't have alcohol, and the consumer became aware of that brand as a non-alcoholic brand. And now all of a sudden there's an alcoholic version, right? Hard Mountain Dew. Or there's spiked Sunny D, right? And so what this bill is saying is in those instances where consumer confusion can occur, a minor could grab it by accident, a parent could grab it by accident, you need to do more marketing, right? You're not going to put Hard Mountain Dew right next to regular Mountain Dew. You're not going to sell spiked Sunny D right next to regular Sunny D. That's what the bill is saying. It's really a responsible marketing bill that says we're not going to create confusion for the consumer about what is alcoholic and what's not.
The Senate also just passed bills your association supports that would set penalties and potentially revoke liquor licenses for retailers defaulting on electronic payments to wholesalers. This seems like a very niche concern. How big of a problem is that?
It's a huge problem. So if you think about any industry, if you go to your local grocery store right now and you get a dishonored payment, your grocery store assesses you a fine, right? Your bank assesses you a fee, a call of fee for that. In the alcohol industry, we weren't able to do that. So a retailer pays you dishonored payment, we weren't able to assess a fee like every other business does. So one of the bills was simply saying, you're going to be able to assess a fee. And then I think if you, during the testimony, you heard one person testifying, one, trade association testifying that there's only 50 violations, under 50 violations a year. And that's actually very telling because there's over 5,000 bounced payments a year just to beer and wine distributors. That doesn't even count the state of Michigan and who sells spirits, who's also getting bounced checks. So you've got about 1% of the actual bounced payments that are making it to a violation hearing. And what our bill said was, if you have three of those violation hearings, you're going to have to face, a suspension. And I think the original bill said if you had six, you're going to be terminated. Now, to get to three, right, you've done hundreds. And so it was a little disappointing for us to hear these groups come out and say, oh, we don't want to protect people who are bad actors and bouncing checks left and right. Well, to get to a violation, you've already bounced 100 or more, well over that many more. And that's kind of the story that didn't come out. But ultimately, the bill did make it out of committee. It made it out of the Senate. It's now at, in the House in reg reform. And it's got good support because people recognize we made some changes. You're not going to get you won't be terminated now. You're going to get some fines issued if you bounce. But before you even trigger those, you have bounced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of checks or electronic payments now, EFTs, right? Because that's how they pay for alcohol now. So you really are talking about just irresponsible actors, people who are gaming the system, trying to basically operate on credit when you're not allowed to operate on credit in the alcohol industry.
So another topic, I think the average Michigan beer drinker or pop drinker or sparkling water drinker might not know all the background on it is our bottle law. And yes, we all know we can return our cans and bottles for 10 cents each. But it's not as simple as when, I or the customer buy a case of Labatt, I pay 10 cents extra on each can, and then I get that 10 cents back when I take it to the store, when I return them. Is it? There's more to it. What's the process?
Well, I mean, there's just a lot behind the scenes. So the deposit actually starts at the time the distributor. And when I use a distributor in this sense, I'm talking soft drink distributors too, not just beer distributors. When you sell it to the retailer, you have to collect the 10 cents and you are responsible for accepting that container back from the retailer once they get it back from the consumer, right? So it works. Distributor charges retailer 10 cents, retailer charges consumer 10 cents, consumer returns the container, gets 10 cents from retailer. Retailer then returns the container to distributor and gets the 10 cents. And then the distributor is responsible for picking all those up, getting them out of the retail location, making sure the dimes are returned, giving unclaimed dimes back to the state of Michigan, getting those recycled. A lot of people don't realize those containers, something has to happen to them when you bring them back to the distributorship. Obviously, some aluminum is easier to recycle than glass. Glass is sometimes you have to pay to get rid of it. And then there's PET, and then there's trucks you have to have, and there's a lot of equipment involved, crushing the glass, shredding the aluminum, binding it. There's a lot of cost, over $60 million a year just for beer distributors to operate the bottle bill.
So now that we have all of that background, which is really helpful, can you tell us about the bill that just passed the House that would create a credit for distributors in this process?
So when the bottle bill first passed, there was this, they were called unclaimed deposits, and that's just the dimes that are associated with the containers that never came back. The consumer never returned them. Those stayed with the distributor, and the distributor was able to use those to build the infrastructure for the bottle bill because there was no infrastructure when the bottle bill first passed. Just overnight, all of a sudden you needed trucks and all this binding equipment, crushing equipment, shredding equipment, bins, employees to take these back. And the on-claim deposits were used to do that. In 1989, the legislature took those away and they sent them to Department of Environmental Quality, or now DEGL, and so that none of that money comes back to the infrastructure of the bottle bill. The infrastructure has to be built by the people who are actually running it, which are retailers and distributors. So what this credit does is it now, for the first time since basically 1989, there was a brief window in the 2000s where this credit existed. It got eliminated when Governor Snyder came in and he redid all the business taxes and eliminated the credit. But other than the 2 years of that, there has been no money to rebuild the infrastructure. So this would provide a credit so that distributors would then get a credit for what they're selling to help go back to rebuild the infrastructure of the bottle bill so that consumers can have an easier time returning their containers. That's what the bottle bill says. It actually says in the bottle bill that it is supposed to be an easy way for consumers to return the containers. And as we're seeing, it's not easy anymore. Bottle rooms, if they're open at all, are overcrowded, they're dirty, they're messy. The machines aren't always working. It's hard to be able to pick them up on a daily basis. So the infrastructure needs to be rebuilt.
So what about the bottle law as a whole? How well would you and your members say it's holding up almost 50 years since voters passed it?
My membership supports the bottle bill, which is unusual because most business groups that have to deal with it don't support the bottle bill, but we do. I think up until COVID, it was holding in there, right? We had return rates that were high 80s, low 90s. You know, a few foreign containers, you know, containers that shouldn't be in there were in there, but the return was pretty good. And Michigan's was the best in the nation. COVID changed consumer behavior, and those rates now have dropped down into the 70s. And we probably need to get a renewed emphasis on having people return those containers. And I know that there's one of the groups we work with, UBCR and Shoepan Recycling, they're doing a campaign right now to try to get people to return their containers. But we think the system as a whole is pretty sound as long as we have investment going into the system. It'll work. It's just there hasn't been investment, and we've had some consumers change their behavior coming out of COVID because, you know, the bottle rooms got shut down and people got used to throwing them in their curbside or just, unfortunately, throwing them away.
So I'm curious. I'm one of those people that I put my bottles and cans in the recycling. I don't take them in for a lot of those reasons that you said. It's time consuming. It's messy. Is there a difference in between, as long as you recycle them, is there a big... Why is it better to still take them in for that 10 cents if you don't necessarily care about the dimes, I guess?
I don't think they're going to get recycled, right? If you put them in your curbside, they're going to get recycled. If you put them through the bottle bill system, they're going to be recycled. So either way, I would say in terms from a recycling standpoint, you are recycling. And they are probably ending up in the same location, although probably different processes. So you're just giving up your dime, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what you're doing. You're giving up your dime. And if you want to make that choice, I don't think there's a problem with it at all. The thing you get concerned about is people who aren't making the choice. They may not have curbside recycling. You know, I live in East Lansing. We have curbside recycling. Other communities, a lot of communities don't have it. For that consumer, their choice might be they just can't find a store that's open and taking them back because so many stores are not in compliance right now. And so they're throwing away and they're dying. They may want their dime back, but they just can't find an easy way to get it back. And that's where the bottle bill right now is failing the consumer.
So there's always a lot of talk about branding in the industry. The Senate just passed a bill to prevent what critics say is improper branding of products. Can you walk us through what's going on there?
Yeah, so it's not improper branding. So it's been 40 years. There's been a law in Michigan that says if you in the alcohol industry, that if you introduce a new product and you're using an existing brand as a way to introduce that product and market that product, you have to honor the network, the distribution network of the existing brand. So think Budweiser. Anheuser-Busch creates a brand called Budweiser. They appoint a network for it who goes out there, right? They're delivering that to the retailers. They're required to do a cents per case spend in marketing, you know, point of sale marketing, promotion, merchandising to build that brand. And then a few years later, Anheuser-Busch comes out and they say, well, we're going to create Bud Light. But Bud Light is relying on the underlying brand of Budweiser. So it's a brand extension. And what you're supposed to do under the law is that goes to the underlying distribution network of Budweiser. So that's how it works. And so what we've seen in the alcohol industry, it's getting very creative, and that's great, where you're seeing now they'll take a brand that's maybe a beer brand and they'll make a wine brand out of it, or they'll make a seltzer brand out of it. And so a few years ago, the law was changed to say, okay, a brand is a brand. It doesn't matter if it's a seltzer or a wine. If you have a brand out there and then you create an extension, you have to give it to that network. There just was some confusion out there among suppliers, which we saw during the testimony, that that's what the law actually was requiring. And there was some confusion on the definition of a brand. It was very convoluted before. So this bill just clarifies that definition to make it easier for supplier to recognize when they are creating a brand extension off of a brand. And what we saw in the hearings were people actually coming out and wanting to challenge the law that was created 40 years ago in their testimony. It had nothing to do with the actual bill that was just clarifying the definition. It wasn't like, well, we don't like the way you're clarifying the definition. It was, well, we don't like the law at all. Well, it's been the law for 40 years. So, you know, that's what became the point of contention. But again, you know, it passed, it came out of committee 7-1 and it passed unanimously off the 37-1, I think, off the Senate floor. So, I mean, the bill's got good support, and it really just says if you're going to use a brand that people have been building for you to market a new brand, you're going to acknowledge that and give the brand to the people who did it. So any supplier who wants to create a new product and introduce it and not use an existing brand, they can go and appoint whoever they want to sell that brand. It has nothing to do with new brands. It has to do with products that are built off of existing brands.
So Michigan's beer tax, which amounts to about 2 cents for every 12-ounce can or bottle, hasn't changed in almost 60 years. At a fixed rate instead of a percentage, the tax brings in far less in inflation-adjusted revenue than it did 60 years ago. Periodically, when we have budget crunches, someone always brings up, well, what about the beer tax? Maybe it's time to finally raise that. So why not increase it like tobacco and liquor taxes have gone up through the years?
Well, I think the first thing is when you do an analysis of Indiana and Ohio and Wisconsin, we're still higher than them. So we haven't raised it, but we're still higher than our corresponding states. And then we just talked about the bottle bill. When you add 10 cents per container on top of that, a case in Michigan is already $2.40 more than a case in Indiana or Ohio. So if you're a business along those borders, you are already $2.40 more expensive than the guy, you know, 50 yards from you on the other side of the border. And so, and then we also have a higher excise tax. So I think it makes Michigan uncompetitive to increase that excise tax, where we are already the most expensive in the region. So that's not something we'd like to see happen because we do think it would really hurt the border. And plus, you know, excise taxes like that, they're regressive, right? They're a regressive tax, which I think a lot of legislators, when they look at that, there's, you know, regressive taxes oftentimes are not favored. So those are the reasons that, you know, we are not supportive of an excise tax increase.
Okay. So let's close out this segment with some particularly useful information for our listeners in Mishmash land. It's summer. It's hot. It's going to continue to get hotter. What's the trendiest drink out there right now that we ought to consider enjoying on one of these blastedly steamy summer days?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say about that is, you know, when you look at our industry and you know, you were talking about the three-tier system earlier, and One of the things it does, it produces amazing variety, right? So there are, our members sell products from over 2,000 alcohol producers. You can't say that about any other industry. 2,000 alcohol producers, 800 Michigan brands, 42,000 different beers, 1,400 different mixed spirit drinks, over 253,000 different wines at 17,750 licensed retailers. So I don't know what your favorite would be out of all that. I just know you have a lot of choices.
There's a lot of options.
A lot of options. And that's what I think we're the proudest of. You know, things that are hot right now that our members are talking about, seltzers still move. You are seeing for this summer, a lot of the hard iced teas are moving. They're really going well. But we're also seeing a little bit of a revival in some of just your core base beers. Craft industries hit a few headwinds, but there's still some great craft beers out there. Michigan's got some amazing producers of craft beers. I know what my favorites are, but I don't want to sway anybody or upset any of my members if I don't mention one they're selling. But I just think the variety in Michigan's amazing. And if you wait 5 minutes, there's going to be something new, because that's the alcohol industry right now.
All right. Spencer Nevins from the Michigan Beer and Wine Association. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Cheers.
Thanks again to our guest, Spencer Nevins from the Michigan Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gongwer's Zach Gorchow and Alethea Kasbin.
Additional production and editing by Hearns Laguerre Jr. Mixing, mastering, and music by Sam Bobian.
Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Learn more about Gongwer News Service at gongwer.com.
Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this show, you can support WDET by going to wdet.org/give. We'll talk to you next week.